Welcome to the Iyun Podcast, an in-depth look at Haredi society, Israel, and the Jewish people. I am your host, Ari Koretsky, and I invite you to join us as we confront the challenges, joys, and possibilities of Torah-centered living in an evolving world. The Iyun Podcast. Think again. Welcome back, everyone, to the Iyun Podcast. Here on episode 3 and part 2 of our mini-series on Haredim and the Army. Until now, we have been evaluating some particular objections, challenges that a Haredi individual might face while entering the Army, and we'll continue to explore some of those as well in future episodes, as well as outlining some of the solutions and some of the frameworks that have been optimized to offset those objections. But today, we're going to evaluate the topic through a totally different lens, not through the prism of any specific issues, reasons, apologetics, but rather deeply imbibing a profound moral claim made by the whole of Israeli society, and certainly by its more religious sectors, on their Haredi brethren. And I use the word brethren deliberately and advisedly, because this claim, this yearning for equality of sorts, for participation, mutual enlistment, is far from a new one. In fact, thousands of years ago already, as Klal Yisrael prepared to enter Eretz Yisrael, we know that the B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven, members of these particular tribes, approached Moshe Rabbeinu and, given their substantial cattle holdings, made a request. They said, "We see that the land east of the Jordan River is uniquely fertile, perhaps more spacious, maybe both, and we need this land to graze our cattle." And Moshe Rabbeinu in Bamidbar Perek Lamed Beis, Pasuk Vav, famously responds to B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven and says to them, "Ha'cheichem yavou la'milchama v'atem teshvu po." Should your brothers, and again the word brothers, should your brothers go out to war while you stay here, while you remain behind? The Jewish people were about to cross over into the land of Israel, into Canaan, and to wage battle with the idolatrous nations living there. And while Moshe, in principle, was prepared to allow these specific tribes to remain behind so that they could graze their cattle, perhaps enlarging the borders of Eretz Yisrael, nonetheless, he insisted that the men from these tribes participate in the military effort to conquer the land. And that is a cry, the echoes of which reverberate throughout the generations, certainly in our own, when we see so many dying on the battlefield, bloodied and injured, mothers and fathers unable to sleep due to fear and worry, and yet one particular subsect of the Jewish community seems immunized from these anxieties, from these travails. And while this particular pasuk is often quoted, especially in our current context, I feel compelled to add what the Psukim go on to say even further, because it really makes the point that much more powerful. After Moshe Rabbeinu utters those famous words, that rhetorical repudiation, he continues on, "Why will you turn the minds of B'nai Yisrael, of your fellow Jews, from crossing into the land? You're making it look too good over here. And furthermore, this is what your fathers did when I sent them to survey the land." Moshe analogizes the request of B'nai Gad, B'nai Reuven, to the actions of the spies just one generation prior. That which demoralized the people, that which deflated them on their journey toward the Holy Land. And in fact, that which ultimately prevented them, that entire generation, from entering into that land altogether. The Psukim continue a bit below. Pasuk Tasvav, "Hinei kamtem tachas avoseichem, tarbus anoshim chato'im lispos od al charon af Hashem el Yisrael." And now you, a group of sinful people, you have added, you have augmented the anger of Hashem towards the Jewish people. "Kiseshuvun me'acharav yosaf od lanichol b'midbar v'shichatem l'chol amazeh." If you turn away from him, he will yet again leave them in the desert and destroy you all. Haunting, almost overwhelming words from Moshe towards these tribes. And in response, they ultimately relent said, we will build sheepfolds for our flocks here and cattle towns for our children. But we will ourselves go armed with the rest of the Jewish people while our families remain behind in this land, loosely translated. So we will not return home until the rest of the Jewish people, every one of them, have received their portion. And then to this, Moshe agrees. And here, in the interest of time, I'll loosely translate or even paraphrase. If you do this and you go as troops, and every fighter among you crosses the Jordan, and the land has been subdued, then you'll be clean and clear before God and before Israel. The famous words, Yisem nikiyim mi'Hashem u'mi'Yisrael. Now, all of this amounts to a supplication that is both emotional and rational all at once. And one might level the claim that regardless of the competing factors and the other concerns and misgivings, this one moral contention itself might just be dispositive with respect to the question of Haredim and army service. Or perhaps the Haredi community does indeed have what to respond. At the very least, I would argue, and I will on this podcast argue, that the claim must be taken extremely seriously and handled with exquisite care, with the sensitivity due such an existential and profound moral dilemma. On today's episode, we'll speak with, again, returning to our Iyun Institute founder and director, Rabbi Yehoshua Pfeffer, who has thought a great deal about this particular issue and written extensively about it as well, along with Mrs. Ilana Cowland, a noted author, educator, parenting expert, who has toggled herself between both the Haredi and Dati Lumi, Dati Chazak communities, who has personal familial relations currently serving in the army, and who will lend us a mother's voice to this topic, which so often in recent months has actually emerged from the matriarchal side of the proverbial machitza in our community. Episode 3 of the Iyun podcast, Shall Your Brothers and Your Brothers Alone Go to War? Welcome, everyone. Very excited for this week's episode. And in particular, I think tackling an incredibly, incredibly important quandary, challenge, difficulty when it comes to this entire topic of Haredim, the Haredi world, and the army and army service. There's no question that since October 7th, this particular issue that we're going to address today has become far more acute in terms of its urgency and its severity. And that is the idea of sharing the burden, what used to be called, I'm not sure if the term is still used in popular lexicon, but it's called Shivyon Banetel, at least it was. And this notion of, that we have the pasuk in the Torah, Ha'achichem yavou b'molchama v'atem teshvu po, right? That people should go out, some people should go out, and some people should stay back. And how is that remotely tenable in a society in which hundreds of thousands of people, 5% or more of the population, are on the front lines, or at least in the service, people called up in reserves in the hundreds of thousands, leaving their families, leaving businesses behind, leaving everything, lying in the fields of Gaza. And we have other people sitting back and doing their part in some way, perhaps on the civil front, perhaps in the Beis Medrash, but not sharing that burden. I was struck by a story, really just a vignette that took place this week between myself and an older Israeli who had actually just come back from 3 weeks in the border area around Lebanon. And he'd spent 3 weeks in the 3 months in the fields. In fact, we were in a seminar together, and the first night of the seminar, he said, I'm going to be taking my shoes off. He says to everyone in the group, and don't think it's strange. I'm taking my shoes off because I've been wearing combat boots for 3 months, and I can actually relax now and take my shoes and air them out. And so that's what I'm going to be doing. Just everyone should know that. And everyone's like, okay. And so he told me, it was pouring rain. This has been a rainy time in here in Yerushalayim that I've been visiting and recording these live podcasts. And he told me that it was raining. And I said, oh, it's such a difficult time, raining and you know, so hard for everyone walking outside and for while we're here. But it's good for the country, good for the, you know, I said the typical, oh, it's good for the crops, you know, my trying to be sound nice and religious. And he said, Yeah, but it's not good for the soldiers. And I hit me like a ton of bricks. I didn't even cross my mind. Didn't cross my mind. There's people out in the fields sitting out there and being rained upon. What kind of cover do they have? What kind of warmth do they have? And that's a lack of sensitivity on my part, but it also is a sense of how many people are out in the rain and how many people are undercover, even if they're doing wonderful, noble things. At the end of the day, there is an inequality. There is a lack of symmetry there. And so I wanted to start by introducing our panelists today and really trying to understand this question that we're going to discuss, perhaps repackaging, reformulating it, and then addressing it in the way that we can, if there is any quote-unquote answer or approach at least. And I'm going to start with Ms. Ilana Cowland. And welcome, Ilana. Thank you so much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and then perhaps in particular what your relationship is to this topic of the Army.
So I'm from London originally, London, UK, not London, Ontario. And I've been living here for about 20 years. I have sons-in-law in the Army. Sons-in-law now. It's changed from son-in-law to sons-in-law. I mean, my family is interesting because we've definitely shifted towards more and more identity with and compassion for, that part of society. I think when you come from Chutz Laaretz, you come in very, you translate what you were there here, and it doesn't always translate so well, and it takes a while to figure that out. So I have very, country and contribution conscious children. I didn't mean to say 4 C's in a row, but there we go. And that's been a shift over the years. So that's me. I'm an educator, a writer, a mom, a wife.
Tell us a little bit about what kind of education have you done over the years, and what's your sort of sphere?
My sphere. So I've been involved in non-pressurizing education for those who are interested in learning about Judaism over the years. I'm involved more now probably in maybe more emotional topics, relationships, anxiety, parenting, that sort of thing.
I don't know where you find any clients for that, for anxiety. It's a calm and serene world.
Yeah, I should have learned how to monetize on the anxiety. I'd have been a millionaire by now, but yeah. I'll teach anybody who, any idea that's been helpful to me, I'll teach anybody who wants to hear it. You know, that's it's my career path.
And I want to just kind of double click, so to speak, on what you said about that translation, that difficult translation from the Chutz Laaretz identity to here. And of course, I think it's fairly well known that, you know, there's no carbon copy of a American yeshivish or whatever kind of identity here. But I guess, why was it the natural to, why was that the natural destination point for you in Israel to kind of go to, the more right wing, we'll call it, or more Haredi type of, and then what changed over the years?
So when we arrived, Eretz Yisrael was very polarized, especially the big question was where to send your kids to school. And we sat down with the Rav and we were like, we understand that things are more complicated than we think. And should we go the very Haredi route? Should we go the more Dati Lumi route? Like, what do you think? And he said, do you have a television? And we said, no. He said, then you're going to Beis Yaakov. So
I would love to hear what that would sound like today. Do you have a television?
Yeah.
Do you mean my laptop? Do you mean my phone? What's a television?
Right. The options were so polarized that it wasn't complicated. You can't put your kids through being the only kids in the class, not to have this, not to have. So it's a default decision. There was no depth to it. Things change over the years.
Sure.
But when we came, that's where the Matthias was. But of course, when you say Haredi as a British person, which isn't, and I think the community is now perhaps more political than it was, but back in the day it really wasn't, there was just like, you got frummer and your kippah got darker, but nobody knew that had any political ramifications.
It didn't really.
It wasn't,
whether you wear a black hat or you don't,
Right.
But it was a statement, but not a political statement.
It wasn't a political statement, right. So when we were in England, we wanted to be really, really firm because we really, really liked Torah. So that made us Haredi. It wasn't complicated, And then we understood that it comes with a whole bunch of other categorization tags. And that it's a process in finding, figuring out who you are at that point.
And so were there any moments that you can remember that said, like, sort of like, well, this is destabilizing. This is uncomfortable. I need to rethink some things.
I mean, there were many moments. I was discussing one with one of my daughters yesterday, who would definitely call herself Dati Lumi. She's the soldier's wife in a big way. And I said, I think I remember the moment where it all started. And it was, I don't know how old she was at the time. She must have been about 12 something. And we didn't have a television. That's why they went to the Beit Yaakov school. But we were watching the news of Gush Katif. The horrible time of the disengagement, which is very relevant now, sure, but at the time. And she turned around and she said to me, "Mommy, how can it be that this is happening to Klal Yisrael and not a single one of my teachers has even mentioned it? Like, how can it be?" You know, and I thought to myself, she's going to be interested in this one. but I agreed. Yeah. I didn't disagree.
Absolutely. There was real dissonance there.
Yeah. Real dissonance there. Yep. Yep.
Amazing. I want to say Rabbi Yeshua Pfeffer is joining us again, our founder and director of the Ion Institute. He already spoke up, so he kind of spilled the beans, but I gave you that executive privilege, given that you're already known to our audience after these many weeks of podcasts.
Well, Rivera, good to be back. Thank you for hosting me again.
Thank you for joining us. So, Rabbi Yeshua, tell us a little bit about your relationship to this topic, and you know, how would you kind of formulate the question?
Well, I think you formulated it well in the moral sense, in the sense of the moral problem or the ethical issue of one part of the nation enjoying defense. We have a defense, we have an army that's defending us, while not contributing to that defense in the army sense. But I do think it's very important to highlight the special nature of the moment that we're in today. I think post, I never know what to call it, you know, October 7th,
Simchas Torah. No, I'm an American, so October 7th. Yeah.
You know, you don't want to call it Simchas Torah because it's not a Simcha thing. October 7th is obviously a secular date, but whatever we call it, after that event, that calamity and the war that came in its aftermath that we're still in the middle of, let's not delude ourselves, could still be a long and arduous process that's still ahead of us, and it's exacted a terrible cost, while at the same time brought out tremendous bravery, courage, and connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I think on the day after, whenever that should come, there'll have to be a very, very serious rethinking of the positions of Israeli society vis-a-vis the army, and specifically the expectations of the Haredim. And I think in two directions. One direction is the demand from non-Haredi society, and by the way, from a lot of religious people also, that are in expecting the Haredim to pull their weight and to be a part of this. That's on one hand. But on the other hand, and in a deeper sense, it's a question of how does Haredi society step up to the plate of responsibility for Israel, including the IDF? We're going to be in for a time of reconstituting, rebuilding, reimagining what Israel looks like, including its core institutions, and perhaps first and foremost, after everything that we've been through, the IDF, the army. And this is not just a demand, but it's also a tremendous opportunity. And the question is, how do we approach that? How do we live up to this unbelievable moment? And you know, the moral aspect is a deep aspect of that, but I'm looking forward to this conversation of trying to speak that through. I think it's, I think people are looking for some guidance, for some clarity, for some, you know, basic ideas of how do we work through this very thorny issue towards a more productive, towards a more positive space for Haredim and the IDF.
Obviously, this has been a question that's, again, existed for years, but brought into stark relief since October 7th. And there was a very well-known letter that came out from a large group of mothers. And I think the notion that they had was, from mother to mother, we need to speak the language of the heart, the language of parents, bypassing maybe the political system, bypassing even the sort of religious establishment, the rabbinic establishment, and sort of implore their counterparts, the authors coming from the Tilumi world, implore their counterparts on the Haredi, quote-unquote, side of the aisle to take this issue really seriously and to be prepared to engage in a level of sacrifice that they have been shouldering for such a long time. And we know, we've mentioned in earlier episodes that at least to date, and there should be no more korbanos, but probably half of the soldiers killed in operations in the war, about 50% have probably been Dati soldiers. And asking, you know, for others to share that burden. I'm going to ask a lot of you if you'd be comfortable reading the letter, because I want to hear it read in a mother's voice. And I think that'll really bring it home in a much more powerful way. And it's a little bit long, but we'll bear with you. And share it. I think it'll be really important.
An open letter from here, or the whole thing. Yeah. These words are written with a trembling hand and a heavy heart. We, the mothers and wives of soldiers and female soldiers in mandatory service and in the reserves, are now turning to you, the mothers of ultra-Orthodox yeshiva students. Call on your sons to enlist in the IDF. We know that many of you have shared in our grief and bereavement over the fallen for many years, and especially in the difficult days since Simchat Torah. In the last 2 months, we've seen the help and solidarity efforts of ultra-Orthodox women in a variety of ways to help families of evacuees and families of fallen soldiers. We know that many are praying for the welfare of the soldiers, the healing of the wounded, and the return of the hostages. We are also aware that you, like the whole of ultra-Orthodox society, attach great importance to Torah study and see in it a supreme value and even assistance in safeguarding the people of Israel. But none of these can replace enlisting in the IDF. This is the Jewish moral and civil duty of anyone who wishes to live here. The absence of that standard constitutes a distinction between blood and blood. This reality is no longer bearable. For those who think that their son is not suited for military service, we say many of our children are not suited to be soldiers. None of them are suited to die in war. None of us are suited to sending our child to risk his life. We all do this because it's impossible to live here without an army, and we are all responsible for one another. It cannot be that others will take risks and risk their children for me when I and my children will not take risks for them. My blood is not redder than theirs. We've given up hope in the leaders of the ultra-Orthodox society, the heads of yeshivas and kolels, politicians and askanim. Throughout the generations, women in Israel have known how to act with courage and sacrifice, where gedolim and leaders failed. We believe that here too the correction can start with the wives and mothers of Israel. Our request to you is unbearably difficult, but there is nothing more justified and moral because each of us carries this difficulty from the day that their child is born. We call on you to take the lead on these necessary steps to fulfill together with all of us the commandments of you shall not stand by your neighbor's blood and love your neighbors yourself. Call on your sons to enlist in the IDF. We pledge to support you. We would be happy to meet, to talk and think together about how we will act towards the step. It's thanks to righteous women that Israel was redeemed. May it be that thanks to you and thanks to the sons who will be enlisted, that he who makes peace in the highest places will make peace for us and for all of Israel.
That's an incredibly moving letter.
Yeah.
And my feelings about this topic, and I want to turn towards hearing your thoughts and reflections and responses, if there are responses. My feeling, whenever I've had this conversation with people, especially people in the sort of Haredi camp, I always try to begin with the postulate that without a sense of profoundly deep, deep empathy for the question, we can't even begin a conversation. Very often what happens is people are dismissive off the top. They don't need us or this, whatever. There's all kinds of flippant sort of dismissive justifications. And some of them may be compelling factually, even perhaps, and we've talked about that in other episodes. But either way, until a person really grasps the depth of this sentiment, till a person really feels this letter in their bones, I don't think we can begin the conversation. And if you do understand it, it's a totally different conversation. And you know, Pfeffer, you've written a lot about this. Have you felt that the audiences to whom you are writing or with whom you're speaking have come to those conversations from a place of profound empathy? Or is there some groundwork to do before we can even have a dialogue?
So I think that's well put, Ari. There was a piece I wrote a number of years ago that actually made that point quite forcefully and said that we can only begin a conversation on this topic when we understand the deep and profound argument that's being leveled, and put aside now for a moment all the different responses, all of our concerns for our children, issues of identity, issues of isolationism, issues of authority. Put those aside and just dwell for a moment on this argument, the argument of empathy, the argument of morality. I would like to make a point concerning what's happening now, though, which I think is very relevant for this letter, because as you mentioned, the claim over the years that was leveled against the Haredim in the sphere of army service was Shivyon Banetel, which means equality in sharing the burden. I think that right now we need to revise that terminology. And rather than speaking about equality in sharing the burden, we need to speak about Shivyon Ba'achva, equality in our mutual togetherness, equality in our mutual love, mutual affection, equality in being together. Over the last few weeks, I visited a number of army bases for the Shlav Bet. Shlav Bet, as we discussed in a previous episode, is a program for older Haredi individuals who are exempt from army service, but who want to be a part of it. One of Ilana's son-in-laws I met on one of these Shlav Bet programs when I went there to give a shiur. And whenever I was at these bases, about 120, some of them 150 Haredi soldiers. So I asked them, why are you here? What brings you here? And what brings them here isn't an abstract idea of equality. There is no equality. Equality is abstract. It's utopian. You know, the guy serving in the IDF on army radio is not the same as the guy serving in the armored vehicle and in the tanks and so on. So there's no absolute equality. But what there is a shared sense of camaraderie, a shared sense of brotherhood, that we're in this together. And that was the answer that they gave. We're doing this because we feel a sense of achva, a sense of brotherhood, that we're in this together. And how can we not share the burden when we're in this together? How can we sit by and just allow this to carry on without our participation, without us being a part of it? And right now we're not in full-time Torah study. We're not in, you know, we're grown men. We might have a job, but we can take time off from that and we can participate in this project of the Jewish people. And I think that as a clarion call to Haredim is going to be that much more effective, rather than a demand based on this abstract notion of equality, a demand based on, hey, it's all of us together. We're in the same boat over here, and it's a basic moral value that doesn't draw from equality, but draws from a national belonging. We're all in this together. And I think that's what this letter is voicing. I really don't know how many people, how many mothers in the Haredi space this letter is going to reach, but I think that this, the tone and the mode of communication is certainly where we have hope of things moving. And you know, as I mentioned before, it's a thorny issue. We're not going to solve it in one day, but there are low-hanging fruit there,
right,
that can be harvested. And when we have this kind of approach, then I think that those lower-hanging fruit, and that's many, you know, young Haredi men who are there and should be in the IDF right now, to whom many of the arguments that are applied are inapplicable. And I think that this kind of tone, this kind of call can be effective for those low-hanging fruit at least.
Ilana, when you read that letter, what goes through your mind?
I have to say, I think it's the wrong audience. I think, you know, a woman who's been mechunechet in the privilege of her children being, you know, mosenefesh for the value of protecting the land, it's very difficult to assume that a letter that pulls on heartstrings is going to make up all those years of chinuch and mesiras nefesh by saying to somebody else, like, right? I sacrifice my sons, right? You want to sacrifice yours? Like, I don't think it's the right audience. I think the audience is the boys themselves. I think, you know, it's interesting because when you talk about going to the army 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even 4 months ago, it's a, you know, are you the type of person who would go to the army, right? Since October the 7th, that's not what it is anymore. It's a, do you want to help? Do you want to fight? Do you want to protect? Do you want to play a role in making sure that we're going to survive this? That call is a, it's a visceral call. And I think that the soldiers who are, the would-be soldiers, the boys who are, who are the low-hanging fruit, the same expression came to my mind when you said that. And to some degree, they are chomping at the bit to play a role, to make a difference, to, and it doesn't feel anymore like it's a political statement. It feels like an acharis. It feels like a chesed. It feels like a sign of manhood. Like, I know that, you know, it's very difficult for husbands and wives at the moment when the soldiers are coming home, because, you know, the wife's like, yeah, you're coming home, you can help me with dishes. And husbands are like, I really want to go back and risk my life again, because there's nothing more meaningful than, you know, protecting. It's like, it's very primal.
I'd rather do that than do the dishes, but okay.
There's such a visceral sense for a man to protect. I read somewhere recently, it's so true. It's like, we've been thrown into very non-progressive roles. Like, the women are home with the children and the men are out fighting at war. But there is something very strong to that. You know, I don't know if she's going to get very far asking, again, women who are not mechunach in this to suddenly feel so compelled to sacrifice their sons. I don't know if it's a fair ask, but I think the concept of, would you like to join in, you know, the defense of our people, it's so not political at the moment, the desire to fight. It's, I think it's primal and visceral. So I appreciate how this mother feels. I think I really appreciate how this mother feels, but I think that the call is actually a call from the matzav to the young men who want to be part of that. I think it's putting a lot on just, you know, trying to sway that call to the mothers. And I think in general, when you are trying to make a shift in any society, the rule is you don't just come in and announce the shift. It has to happen to some degree organically. That's why this idea of, you know, there are some people who are in a circle who are miles away from this, who just want to put down soldiers and say how terrible they are because they're not learning and we don't even need them, and spit at them. And you've got those people who are miles away from this conversation, right? And then you've got the people who are signing up right now. You know, nothing else matters. And there's a spectrum of people. You know, the way that societies change is actually from within the community. It's not from people on the other side calling at them with a line of, this is what you should feel and this is what you should think and this is what you should do. That's just not how societies have ever changed.
Rabbi Shua, I want to ask, you know, the letter specifically notwithstanding, but if you're talking to a, let's say, an excellent or very solid yeshiva bacher, let's turn to speaking directly to the boys, as Mrs. Callen has said. Does that young man have a cogent moral response? It's assuming that all the other questions could be addressed in one way or the other, and even if they can't be perfectly well addressed, even if it will be hard to daven with a minyan or to learn even Daf Yomi, whatever the situation might be. But at the end of the day, is there a response to this question, to this claim that he has? Whether he's the best boy in yeshiva, the middle, the quote unquote bottom, how does one respond to it? If they, because as I said earlier, if as I predicated, a person needs to engage this question seriously to even respond to it. So once they have engaged it seriously, is there what to respond?
So I think there is, and I think it's, we shouldn't make it too simplistic. Meaning, on the one hand, the moral call is a very clear call on a society-wide basis. Okay, when you think of societies, when you think of groups, then the call is very clear. When we think about individuals, then it's not as clear. It's not as clear-cut because, well, you know, the army has exemptions. The army has exemptions for excelling sportsmanship, for example. Sports people who excel in a certain field get an exemption from the IDF, as do people who excel in other areas of culture and life and so on. Not all of them. And many of them, by the way, say, even though I could get an exception, I'm nevertheless going to step up
Idan,
to the place.
The Fauda actor,
So that happens, absolutely. And by the way, you know, one can only, you know, step back and you know, be absolutely, you know, overwhelmed by these actions of self-sacrifice for the sake of the Jewish people. You know, I've no other way. I've spent so many hours recently on Har Herzl, you know, exponentially more than ever before, you know, October 7th. And just the experience of being in the presence of these families and these fallen soldiers is just, you know, humbling and life-changing, really, literally. But that would be a response. That would be a response of an excelling yeshiva guy. He says, you know what? I appreciate the moral argument of we need to be in the IDF. But if a boy is excelling in his Talmud Torah, then the army ought to give exemptions for them too, just like it gives exemptions for excelling sports people and Kal Vachomer. You know, we need religious leaders. We need those who are going to excel in Torah study. I think the argument that I would like to level is more at the boy who's not excelling in his Torah study. Again, we could speak about those who excel, and let's say there are, you know, 50,000 of them, so what are we going to do? However, you know, we all know that there's a certain strata, you know, society is stratified, it's that there's a certain order, and there are going to be many who are not fulfilling themselves in the yeshiva. And then I would like to level the question at them. Like, why are you not in the IDF? That's where we need to start. That's the quote-unquote low-hanging fruit. And they're not so low-hanging, because once you say, well, I'm not serving because I'm Haredi, I'm not serving because I belong to a society that doesn't serve, that's a hard nut to crack. This letter tries to circumvent that, but you won't succeed. It's almost disingenuous to say, well, let's put aside the Rabbonim, let's put aside the politicians, let's put aside the Askanim. Well, you know, those Rabbonim and Askanim and politicians, they're the ones that represent that Haredi individual. They didn't come out of nowhere, right? Those are the leaders that he looks up to. Those are the leaders whose instruction he receives. So it's not simple to circumvent. Society is politicized. Politics isn't just party politics. You know, society involves politics. But then the question is, you know, like Ilana mentioned, there's a lot of, you know, if you imagine society as a set of concentric circles, right, as an onion. Okay, so you have a lot of different layers over there. And in terms of political identity, so those who are, you know, hardcore, I'm Haredi, so I don't serve. All right, fine. You know that there's nothing to speak about. But once you identify as I'm a part of the Jewish people, my Haredi identity doesn't negate my core identity as part of the Jewish people. And in fact, my identity as part of the Jewish people is stronger than my Haredi identity. Which identity is primary? I think that's a big question. Is my Haredi identity my primary identity? And I do what the Haredim do? Or do I have a primary identity as a member of the Jewish people? And then I have a responsibility, this moral calling, this calling of achva, of being together, of brotherhood, together with everybody else. Then, you know, then there will be boys, you know, because it depends on family, it depends on upbringing, depends on your individual mindset, that, you know, that this plays out in different ways. So for the guy who's going to say, my primary identity is a Vizhnitz Chosid, that's just what I am. I'm a Vizhnitz Chosid. And in Vizhnitz, we don't serve in the IDF. It's a hard nut to crack. But the guy who's coming with a broader understanding of his belonging historically, personally, you know, in terms of where he's at, a guy that's been to Har Herzl, a guy that's experienced, you know, for me, some of these experiences were absolutely foundational. You know, being at Har Herzl, being at a ceremony for fallen soldiers years and years ago, that was foundational. It said, one minute, I'm a part of something bigger here. It's not just about my little belonging to my enclave community. I'm a part of the Jewish people. Once you internalize that, then this calling becomes so much more forceful and so much more inevitable irresistible almost. So I think the question of the politics versus the morality is not a simple one. It's not a simple balance.
But it seems to me, though, that there may be, you know, rabbanim or leaders, what have you, who deliberately will restrict their followers or students from accessing those kinds of emotive experiences precisely for this reason. Because once the cat is out of the bag, once you've been to Har Herzl, once you've stood at a funeral of a lone soldier with 30,000 people or been to Reim or Kfar Aza or whatever it is, you can't unsee that. And mm-hmm. so this is, I think, the challenge is that I think many people would appreciate the moral quandary had they exposure to such types of life experiences, but they're maybe in many cases being prevented from having them.
Well, part of the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world is that not everything is in your control. And the fact of the matter is that today's level of exposure is also, you know, disproportionate to anything that we've ever had before. And that produces different types of boys. They're not one size fits all. They're not all in one mold. You will have those who are, you know, blinkers on, the rabbi said, and that's it. But you'll have a lot of boys who are not in that way. And there are some rabbinic figures who are also more, I would say, appreciative of that situation. They're more, to use a term that I don't know if the rabbis would use, but more laissez-faire, meaning we appreciate that there are different processes in motion, you know, that are happening among the Jewish people. And of course, we want to preserve the elite that are going to be the great Torah scholars, the great Torah leaders of the next generation. But we also understand that there's going to be many who are not going to be a part of that and will be more hands-off concerning them and allow a greater freedom of choice, a greater freedom of motion, and allow a lot of these intermediate organizations or leadership, rabbinic leadership on an intermediate level, to come into that vacuum and to allow, for example, the Netzach Yehuda organization that services Haredi soldiers. So there were rabbis who backed that actively and said, yeah, there's a need for that, there's a space for that. And of course, there were others who opposed it quite strongly. So, you know, that there are different motions even among that rabbinic leadership.
Ilan, in your travels across the Hashkafic spectrum, what have you seen? Are you seeing the sense of deep empathy, and how do you navigate those conversations with other, let's say, women in your community who, you know, just are resolute against, you know, having a member of their family in the army?
I mean, the women I know who really don't want their children to go to the army, generally it's an emotional issue. You know, I'm not so privy to the people who, like Bushtan Panavov and Hashkafali, do not want their children. Once you are privy to a world of, you know, it's kind of normal to be exempt. Like, again, this call to go on, just sacrifice it, because that'll make it fair. It's just not how women work. If you don't have to, you don't, you know. But I would also say, and I think this is, if I can add just to this conversation, you know, I think you've also got to take a look at what's happened over the last few decades in the country. You know, it's happened in a very weird hashkacha that has happened to the ultra Haredi society and also to the super secular Zionist society, that between 1948 and now, you know, there's been a very big change on both those fronts, right? There was such a strong imperative in 1948. If you were from Haredi, I would say, to rebuild the Torah world, and if you were Zionist, to make sure that there was going to be a shelter so that, you know, that would never happen again, right? And the imperative, they had a goal to recreate and to rebuild and to achieve. And the one thing nobody really counted on was the possibility of them achieving the goal, right? So we didn't really have a plan for what happens post-goal. So two things have happened. One is that, again, we have a country, okay, and it's been a bit threatened recently, but the basic feeling is, you know, if you watch a Yom HaTzmut video of 1958, they weren't sure that this miracle of 10 years was going to last. And nobody celebrates Yom HaTzmut now wondering whether Israel's not going to be hit here next year. It's like they've really achieved a safe homeland. And the Haredim have really rebuilt the Torah world. In the meantime, the societies have gotten much bigger. So what you have in the Haredi world is you're no longer the tiny minority of clergy that David Ben-Gurion, you know, exempted from serving, you are now on track to becoming the majority. So you have to change where you position yourself demographically when you're the majority. Number two, because you've got more people, you know, and it's sort of like a genetic, it's almost like a legacy, you know, that you're now going to sit and learn. Not everybody is going to be absolutely worried to sitting and learning in such an extreme way, because you're talking about hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people, not like a small group. And number three, and I think this is probably the most important thing, the call for total mesiras nefesh, whether that comes in learning, poverty, you know, it doesn't feel like an imperative in the same way anymore because it's been accomplished. So, you know, there are many Haredi kids who are just like, yeah, we don't want to be poor either. You know, we're going to go to work. Forget the army. We're going to go to work because there's no reason to be poor. There's enough of us. There's people learning. Torah world's been built. I don't have to be most nefesh with poverty. And I think there's such a shift in how the generation that you're talking about is feeling. They may have their abeim, and there may be some people who are very much, you know, in the hub and under the command of their abeim. But there is also, they are a very discerning crowd. They don't just obey and do what they're told. They've watched Mesiras Nefesh. They don't have the same really strong need to be Mesiras Nefesh because the Torah world has been rebuilt, so it's just not the same imperative, right? And they feel that something's shifting inside of themselves anyway, that where am I? How do I contribute? How do I feel successful? What do I want my family to look like? I'm part of the majority now. I'm not part of the minority anymore. So I'm forcibly integrating into the land. What does it look like? What does it look like when half the country is Haredi? Like everybody's just sitting and learning? It doesn't work that way anymore. There's an organic change and a natural change. And I think that's, I just don't think it's possible to demand the same levels of insularity and serious nefesh when you've shifted from a minority that's trying to achieve a goal to a majority that's actually achieved it.
I mean, what's interesting though is that, you know, when you say what will happen when half the country is Haredi, and I was speaking to a young yeshiva student, I don't want to be too specific, but I was asking, you know, what's said in your school about these topics and so forth, high school, yeshiva katana, as they call it here. And he said, you know, they see daven for the soldiers. You know, he said, we daven. I said, how specific is it? Is it about Tzahal? He said, we daven that Hamas should be destroyed however they need to be destroyed. Ki'ilu, like they'll just like disintegrate into, you know, thin air.
Sancheriv.
Like vaporize, yeah. Yes, Sancheriv. You know, and I didn't push it with him, of course, because, you know, I don't want to destabilize him and get in trouble with his parents. But, you know, it's with this kind of a mentality, one does wonder. Yes, I mean, at some point that will be the case, 50%. Will we expect some sort of, you know, magic solutions? I don't know.
Well, just to tag on to what Ilana was saying, if you take even a further step out, another zoom out level, I think it's there's something very deep going on in the state of Israel. On one side, within Israel, just broader Israel, and on the other hand, within the Haredi space. Broader Israel has become much more frum. Broader Israel has become much more connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on multiple levels. And of course, that's also come with a price tag, because there's been this, you know, prior to October 7th, we had this great backlash from the old elites of the more secular left, if you want to call it that way, or however you want to call it, that of course, you know, look at what's going on in Israel and see it with great dismay and with great alarm. And we have to take that into consideration, and things will have to be done differently. And I don't want to go back to the question of the judicial reform. But the fact of the matter is that Israel has become much more firm. You mentioned before the soldiers that are being killed in battle. Like I said before, amazing, you know, beacons of light, amazing examples that the letters they leave behind, the spirit that they have, is just mind-boggling, you know, really incredible. And those are frum, many of them are frum, they're shomer mitzvahs, they're learning. You know, Rav Asher Weiss always tells me, he says this publicly also, that they put out this pocket version of Minchas Asher for soldiers to learn while they're in battle. And I know personally several soldiers who have this. I have a rabbi friend in Ramat. His son is in the IDF. He has these pocket Minchas Asher. And Rav Asher told me, he said, listen, you know, I'm very happy anybody who's learning Minchas Asher. But the soldiers on the battlefront are learning Minchas Asher. Like, that's just beyond belief. That gives me more nachas than anything else can possibly give me nachas in terms of people studying my Torah. And we look at that, and we say, hey, you know, is that Tzva Hashmad? Is that, you know, we were told that the army is this, you know, terrible, terrible institution where you go there, you'll come out, you know, with horns and be anti-religious. This is not your Tzva Hashmad. So Israel is, on the one hand, becoming more accessible, more possible. There's still a long way to go. There's still a lot of work to be done. But that's a clear and very, I would say, consistent trend. And at the same time, Haredim are becoming much more Israeli. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's a generational gap over here. You know, the mother, somebody told me, a friend of mine told me that she spoke to a woman about army service for her kids. This woman was like, wow, you know, a bit emotional, like you said, Alana. She said, well, you know, I don't understand it. Like, how can it be that I won't know where my son is? You know what? I wonder where he is, you know, but you know, the Yiddish mamas are very, you know, they're very controlling, and you get used to this situation. But the kids are very Israeli, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of mm-hmm. the culture, in terms of the music, in terms of the belonging, in terms of the interest, in terms of the politics, in terms of the slang, they're very Israeli. Even when we're speaking about mainstream yeshivas, there's a lot of Israeli-ism that has penetrated, that has filtered in. Listen, you're in the same country. You share the same challenges, the same language, the same geographical, everything is shared. It's going to happen. And this comes with baggage. It comes with real ramifications. One of my daughters is now studying in a Datilumi Midrashash. She said, you know, Abba, I want to try this. I want to try, you know, something else. And I don't think that's exceptional. Maybe it's exceptional that it went smoothly, and that, you know, it's all cool. We're very happy. We just went there the other day. It's an amazing place. But that's the fact of the matter. And this raises just tremendous potential, mm-hmm. tremendous potential. I think, you know, the state needs the Haredim because they need this equality. They need this sharing. Or like I said, instead of sharing the burden, sharing the brotherhood, okay? They need that. That they're dying to see that. Our friends, especially in the religious Zionist world, this letter, that they're dying to see this brotherhood, this, but the Haredim, for them, it's this amazing, amazing opportunity. You know, like Ilana said, we're not in 1948, we're big, we're strong, we're confident. Betach b'Hashem v'asei tov, you can have bitachon in Hashem and you can do so much. We can bring so much blessing, so much bounty, so much connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for these institutions that need them. And it's such a moment. I think, you know, it would be a travesty. It would be terrible if we are unable to take advantage of this unique moment of this coming together in this, you know, post October 7th world and not be able to reap something great for the future of the Jewish people.
I mean, what I'm hearing is also that there maybe is a generational divide. Yes. Because when you speak to a certain, you know, a certain class or category of rabbonim of a certain age, you don't get the sense that there's a real buy-in to this kind of sense of opportunity, sense of possibility, even on any level, really. At least those that I've spoken to in certain sectors. Whereas it sounds like younger Israeli Haredim are, by nature of living in a more open world and by nature of the exposure they've had, maybe they're sort of from the ground up going to take that mantle. It's a little bit what I'm hearing. I mean, are you seeing that a lot in this kind of generational shift?
Yes, definitely. I'm seeing that. And I also feel that you talk about formative experiences, you know, like we can't underestimate that probably the most formative experience that the upcoming generation will have been through is going to be October the 7th, meaning that super desire to be here and to be proud and to protect and to play a role and to contribute. And so at the moment everyone's like trying to find their place in it. Or if you're a trained soldier, you pick up a gun and you know, nice and easy, you know, but if everybody else is trying to find their place, but this you know, every tragedy has its phoenix, you know. And it, to me, if there's going to be a phoenix over here of this horrific situation that let's, like you said, is still ongoing, it's not like it's behind us. You know, there's been these two sides of the community that have really lost their way. I have to say, you know, again, not because the Zionism has been forgotten or because Haredit has been forgotten, but because when you've got the upcoming generation who are not spurred on by, you know, by a real ideology, because it's like rich kids from poor grandparents. Like, they're just not going to go to work with the same enthusiasm that their grandparents went to, because they've got plenty of money. Like, it's sort of like what happens when you succeed too much. And we saw the fighting and the infighting. Everybody had too much time on their hands. Everybody had nothing to do. There was this like lack of sense of mission in this country. And pitom, it's not just that we've been united over our enemy, but I think our enemy has also just opened up what's really, really important to us. And I think that's a formative experience that you're not going to be able to take away from anyone. And I kind of feel like there's this, maybe I'm being a bit utopian over here, but there's this incredible opportunity for the goof of the country, which was the security and the country and the institutions and the bituach lami and, you know, the body of the country and the neshama of the country, which has been Torah, Hashem, you know, mitzvahs, to say, you know, we actually are really inspired by the same goal, which is like the love that we have for our land, for what we stand for. Maybe we have to figure out the mission a little bit more clearly, but you know, but the and we experienced an assault and we care about this. And I almost feel like there's a possibility of both things, the remembering why, what our mission is and what our goals are, and the really coming together to share that in a way that this country's never had before, I don't think. And I think the army conversation will almost become a default. You know, again, you'll have a lot of people, and if it's within their term to contribute that way, they kind of just will. I think it'll happen, you know, organically. I don't think you have to do this. I don't think you have to go up to a mother who is not trained from a different generation and say, "Do you mind sacrificing your child?" Like you go against just every maternal bone in the body, but you can say to the next generation, you know, you really, really want to contribute? Like, do you really, really care? Like, do you want to play a role that's matim for you? And now that there's a lot of us and we're all in this together now, you know, like where is your role? And if your role is here, then go play it. And if your role is elsewhere, then go play it. But I think we finally have an opportunity to, what's the expression? The great divide to
bridge.
Thank you. I don't speak any language soon. Yeah, totally. I don't speak English anymore. To bridge the great divide. And I think also, especially in the younger generation, the amount of times I've heard people say, "God, the war between the Haredim and the Zionists, it's such an old war. Nobody cares anymore." Like, yalla.
Who of you would say that?
I started hearing it in my generation from me. <You know?
laughs> Glad someone's paying attention
but
to
now,
you.
But now, yeah, there we go. I was listening all along. But I'm hearing it, like, you know, with oomph in the next generation. Like, you know, enough. Again, not deep, dark, you know, deep, dark gola, and not deep, dark, you know, or deep light. I don't know how you want to call it. Obviously, there's going to be extremes within, but when you have a lot of people, you have a natural concentric circle, and the concentric circles overlap. And there is so much more access to the mechane meshutaf of what we care about and what we share as young, you know, from Israelis, less from, more from, you know, my parents are more Haredi, your parents are more Datilumi, your parents are more Chiloni, but actually we have an overlap because there's a lot of us and we're young and we want to, you know, figure out who we are, what we want to do. We want to make this country work. The things that we care about actually have started to unite us much more than the things that our grandparents used to fight about. Like, they just think it's happened. I think the time has well come for the new vision to take over the battles of the old vision.
So, Ilana, when I hear you speak, what's coming to mind, an image is coming to my mind, which is the difference between someone pointing a finger at another versus them reaching out their hand to another person. And what I've been hearing you say consistently throughout this conversation has been that the sort of, you need to you need to do X, Y, or Z, you need to be, you know, to be in the same boat as us, you know, isn't going to do as much as kind of going to maybe the targets themselves and saying, "Here, we're reaching out a hand." And as Rabbi Yeshua's idea of, you know, be with us in brotherhood, you know, shivyon ba'achva. And it seems like, I guess a more impactful or appropriate way of connecting to people, which is, I think, is fairly consistent in this generation all around in terms of the need for the ase tov, the drawing near, this, you know, yamin makariv, more than ever before. And you know, it seems like that's the only way to really reach people.
Well, if you know, first of all, yes, but I would also push back on that a little bit.
You're supposed to say yes, and that way I feel a little better about it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, what's wrong with yes, but? I said the first part also.
I just learned all about the polarities of thinking, and so in polarities, thinking yes, and that way I don't feel so denigrated.
Who was it that said facts don't care about your feelings? I'm not going to go that way.
That's too political, even though you aren't a conservative think tank over here, but it's okay.
But listen, you know, on the one hand, achva is super important, and you know, the sense of brotherhood, the sense of togetherness. And that's why we wake up in the morning to do things because of love, because of care, because of compassion, because of brotherhood. It's a big deal. And I saw in Shlav Bet, that's why people were coming. Absolutely. I think there's something that is worthy of being added. And that is that ultimately there are some things that stop making sense. That they make sense up to a certain point in time, that they make sense for a certain generation or in a certain semantic field, and then just suddenly they stop making sense. And, you know, in this case, I think we're reaching a point in time where for too many people, it stops making sense that there's this broad and sweeping exemption from army service. It just doesn't make sense anymore. I recall a conversation between two bank workers, one of them Hasidic guy, Chassid, the other one, Datilumi, and they both worked in a bank. And they spoke about kids. And the Hasidic guy asks the Datilumi guy, well, you have a son, what's he going to do? Well, he said, well, he's going to graduate school a couple of years' time. Is he going to do the army? He says, yeah, of course he's going to do the army. We all do the army. He says, I don't understand you guys. How can you do the army? It's mamash pikuach nefesh. Now, that argument of it's mamash pikuach nefesh, right? Pikuach nefesh for who? Right? It's pikuach nefesh for the Jewish people, yes, because we need to fight an enemy and we have to be in the army. And of course, it involves risking your life. But who's risking your life? We're going to pull out from army service because it's my pikuach nefesh. Who's going to come instead of us? That makes sense when you have a very strong them and us divide. Okay? So for us, it would be pikuach nefesh, let them do it. But I think as that divide is bridged, as we come closer to one another, as we stop thinking so sharply in terms of them and us, but rather in terms of a collective we, even though notwithstanding differences in mindsets and values and lifestyles, absolutely, but still it's more of a collective we, and that's happening. And that's happening. Again, we had, you know, times of social strife prior to 7th of October, but overall, there's a coming together, and it just stops making sense. And you need people to call that out. It doesn't happen by itself. You need voices. You need people to project that, to make that point in a whole variety of platforms and voices and languages and so on. But it's out there, and then it does something. So yes, it's less effective when it comes from the outside, because that creates a pushback. Who are you to tell us? Blah blah. Even though the tone here is you know, it pulls at heartstrings. But when that happens from the inside, when you have voices and you have them, then some people are going to listen. And especially, as Ilan has been saying, especially the youth themselves, who have been brought up in a new generation with altogether, you know, different kind of, you know, that they don't see themselves as weak and meek and feeble, and you know, we're the kaneh, there was a piece in Sarachion about the difference between the cedar and the reed, right? The cedar of the Tanakh and the reed of Chazal, and how we look at it at ourselves as being weak, and you know, we need to
exilic,
we need to be subdued. Haredi youth today do not look at themselves that way. That's not the internal motion, and I think that's going to make a big difference in the coming years.
Let's hope that we can resolve this moral quandary by seeing people stepping up in a way that makes sense, that's natural, that's organic, but ultimately that is taking achrayus, taking responsibility for themselves, their families, for Klal Yisrael, and with minimal strife and Maximal Achva, as he pointed out so many times. Ilana Kelland, Rabbi Yeshua Pfeffer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, nice to be here.